Please make your way in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, written by Solomon, who obviously is one of the main things that he is known for is the wisdom that God gave to him. He asked not for riches and wealth and power, but for wisdom to rule God's people, so God blessed him with wisdom. And that wisdom was seen in his early days when, you know that story that was told about him, where there are two women that came in and they're fighting over a baby. And the one woman said, well, cut him in half and share him. And the other one said, no, just give it to the other gal. And Solomon wisely knew who the real mom was, because she showed the true spirit of a mother. And so she gave it to the one that was willing to give up the child. Well, the Jews have another story about Solomon in his old age, that boy grew up, and there's a controversy over him, and two women came in and said that he has pledged to be married to my daughter, so we both want him. And Solomon thought, well, it worked the last time, maybe I'll try it again. So, okay, let's cut him in half and give him to both of you. You each have a half. And one woman said, no, give him to the other gal. The other gal said, I don't care, cut him in half. And this time Solomon said, I'm going to give him to the gal that said, cut him in half, because you have showed the true spirit of a mother-in-law already. And so, one thing he knew was mother-in-laws. He had 1,000 of them. So he grew in wisdom. As we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, it is written near the end of his life. And this morning we're going to be focusing on chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 11. And what he's going to say is that I used all the wisdom I had, and I pursued after every opportunity to find the meaning of life or find something that would satisfy. And so you got a couple of two things with Solomon, that he not only had wisdom, he also had the opportunity to pursue everything because he had all the money, wealth, and power to do so. So I've entitled the message, If Only. And what I mean by that is people say, well, if only I had this, then I'd be happy. If only I could attain to this level of something, then I'd find satisfaction. And people are in the pursuit of happiness thinking that I'm really kind of happy, but I'd really be happy if this happened in my life. And that's what Solomon wants us to see, that that is not the case. Because he had not only the wisdom, he also had the opportunity to experience everything, and he's passing on that to us. And so our study this morning will cover 4 points, really 4 different areas that he pursued after, coming to the same conclusion that's throughout the book. It's like grasping for the wind. It's vanity. There's really nothing left over if you grab a hold of something and think this is what's going to give me meaning and purpose and lasting satisfaction in life. So the first pursuit is wisdom in verses 12 through 18. We'll spend a lot of our time on this because I think there's a lot in this portion. And then we'll look at the other 3 pursuits in chapter 2. But let's read verses 12 through 18 of chapter 1. And we'll come back through and look at this pursuit of wisdom, kind of dissected in 4 areas. It says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, and have gained more wisdom than all who are before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Let's look at this from 4 aspects of this pursuit of wisdom. In verse 12, in the beginning of verse 13, I want to put this in the historical context, the setting of which he is saying this. He says, I, the preacher, the king, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And again, as we looked at last week, preacher doesn't necessarily mean like a pastor preaching a message. It really means a searcher, even a philosopher, someone that's investigating things and trying to draw some sort of conclusion. Then he communicates that conclusion. That's why preacher is one of the translations. And so now in this section, he kind of goes from the third person in verses 1 through 11, just kind of generalities that he was saying about life, now to what he personally has done. And as I said, we'll look at four paths that he pursues. It says, "And I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven." Let's stop there. Notice it says to seek and to search. And those, you can read and say those are just two ways of saying the same thing, but not exactly. The first word, to seek out, literally means like more to drill down deep, to investigate every little detail about something. And then the second word, to search, is more like a kind of a general observation, a survey of things. So he surveyed things, and then he also drilled down deep into every area that his wisdom allowed him to pursue after. So the first word is more like a doctoral dissertation. When you write a doctoral dissertation, you have to find something that no one else has researched and kind of make it smaller and smaller and smaller. You can't say, "I want to study the sun," or "I want to study the moon," or "I want to study the planets." You have to study something very tiny and specific and drill down deep. So, for example, I found one that I thought was interesting in psychology, a dissertation. And this is the title of it: "An Examination of Examination-Related Anxiety in Final Year University Students." So the study was studying the anxiety that's created in the final year of students over tests they have to take. Now that's really, really specific. And so Solomon is saying, I broke it down and I looked at things and here's the conclusions that I've come to. But in order to kind of really grasp the wisdom that Solomon has, let's look at 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 29 through 34. It describes the wisdom that God gave him, and he had all this at his, you know, basically at his disposal to seek out these things. 1 Kings chapter 4, let's pick it up. Unless I got the wrong Kings. Maybe I got supposed to be 2 Kings. No. Oh, there it is. I'm sorry, right in front of me. It's early, so give me a break. Have mercy on me. Now or for now, that wouldn't happen. All right, 1 Kings 4, verse 29 through 34. "And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding, and largest of heart, like the sand of the seashore." So this guy had more wisdom than anyone other than really Jesus. "Thus Solomon's wisdom exceeded the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite and He-Man," so even smarter than a superhero, "Charcoal and Darda, the sons of Mahal, and his fame was in the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs." Even the proverbs we have, he had plenty more to pass on. "And his songs were 1,005. So talk about a musician, talk about talent. He not only had wisdom, he was also an artist and wrote 1,005 songs. Also, he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." So this guy had knowledge, wisdom in just about every area of life possible at that point. And this is what he used to investigate life. Let's go back to the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, it's obvious, you say, well, how did such a wise man with all that wisdom fail? How did he end up having his heart turned from God? That's really the answer of the book that he's saying in this section. Wisdom in itself is not good enough. Wisdom in itself is not going to satisfy. And before you're too hard on Solomon, let's examine ourselves. All of us know more of the Bible than we live out, right? And I preach more of the Bible than I actually live out. And you may say, oh, you're a hypocrite then. No, hold on. That just shows that you're doing the same thing, because if that's what you think, you shouldn't be judging me, and the Bible says not to judge. So we all know more of the Bible than we actually live out. So it's not just knowledge that is going to rescue a person's life. Obviously, we need knowledge, we need wisdom, but we also need to ask God to have a heart to be able to apply that wisdom that the Bible gives us as well. So that's a historical setting, context for Solomon. He had all the wisdom, all the resources, and he investigated life. Here's his conclusions. The second thing I want you to see, and I think this is great, and it helps us understand what the meaning of the book is, and that's the second part of verse 13, the divine conflicts. So he had wisdom, he goes to seek out life, and look at the way he describes it. Search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under the sun. This phrase, this burdensome task. Burdensome task. That means there's a difficulty in this. Figuring out life. Figuring out the way life should work is not an easy thing, because it says that God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. So God has designed life in such a way that you have to try and figure out what life is all about. It's a burden and it's an exercise. That means you don't just kind of fall upon it. There's a struggle. There's a battle. And for myself, I just like to say before we kind of dig into here, I like life and I like the battles that are in life. I like the struggle that is there. I like the process. I like that there's a challenge, something to try and figure out. I like puzzles. I like to do crossword puzzles. I like to do, you know, other puzzles. That's the way I'm bent. And so God gives life as a challenge, and I'm glad because it motivates me to do something. It doesn't just hand us all the answers. And I hate really when things end, especially movies that I like. Now, a lot of movies are coming out in series, and when the last one comes out, it's like, I'm bummed. I like watching the whole process come through. So when Frodo had to throw that ring into the volcano, depression came over me for weeks. But the burdensome process, we looked at this verse last week, and I want to read it to you. You can turn there if you want. And then I'm going to read it through a number of other translations. And it talks about God subjecting creation, which would involve us, to emptiness, to vanity, to frustration. That's the way life is designed. God has purposed it to be this way. Romans 8 verse 20 says this, "For creation was subjected to futility, not willing, but because of him who subjected it in hope." And it's because when Adam sinned, creation fell. We call it the fall of man. So man's in this environment of vanity and futility, and God's not handing out the answers. We're not living in a paradise. We're not living in the Garden of Eden where you just kind of live and there's no opposition. We're under the influence of sin. And so now, because of that, it drives us to find meaning and purpose in life. Because man doesn't, he's not born with it. I believe that man is born with some sort of emptiness that's there that only God could satisfy. There's a spiritual need. There's people call it a hole in the soul that only God could plug up that hole with himself. And so man has to struggle and figure this out. And that's a good thing, because if God just kind of left us to ourselves and the way things are, we'd never turn to God. I'm glad there's a battle, a burden that I got to figure out what life is all about. So here's some of the translations. The Amplified Version puts it, I'm going to read the first phrase because I got about 20 of these verses. "For the creation was subject to frustration and futility." That's why mankind is frustrated, because they know something, there's a missing piece, and they got to figure out what that is. And God designed life that way. The problem is they seek in all the wrong places and come to the wrong conclusions, and they make a conclusion and then they're still frustrated. That's what Solomon is saying through here. Another Amplified translation, for the creation was subject to frailty. I'm not going to tell you what these translations are. I'm just going to read through them. Creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice. Another one, meanwhile, creation is confused. And I love this one. Everything God made was allowed to become like something that cannot fulfill its purpose. That's mankind as well. Man cannot fulfill his purpose alone, so that's why he pursues after these things, and God's designed life that way. For creation was condemned to lose its purpose. You see, all creation has collapsed into emptiness. Or one translation simply says, the world was spoiled. It did not want to be spoiled, but God allowed it. The Phillips translation says, let's see if I can find it. The world of creation cannot as yet see reality, not because it chose to be blind, but because in God's purpose, it has been so limited. One other translation. Everything in creation is being more or less held back. And so Solomon says that God's allowed this to take place. It's the God-given task. And there's some people, bottom line, they're wimps. Life pushes them a little back, and they just kind of cave over and say, oh, this isn't fair, foul, this isn't right, and then they want to get mad at God. But God made us in His image and His likeness, and we're longing for Him to have a relationship that's there, and so we have to push through and try and figure out how all this puts together. This is the way we are because of sin. A couple other passages of Scripture. Go over to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. Verse 11 and 12 says the same thing, same principle. Verse 11 says, He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I mean, everybody is born with the idea that there's something beyond the grave, but they can't figure it out, is what Solomon says. Verse 12, I know that nothing is better for them to rejoice and do good in their lives. I'll read a passage out of the New Testament. Acts 17, verse 26 and 27 says this. He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell in all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, verse 27 especially, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope in Him and find Him, though He is not far from any of us. So God says, I designed the nations, I made man from all one blood, then I put them in different spots, and I designed it in a way that man would seek after God, grope after Him in the dark, even though he's not far from. So life is designed in such a way that there's a missing piece. A man's trying to put all the pieces together. Let me illustrate it this way. It'd be like if I gave you a puzzle, and I said, now form a circle with this puzzle. But I mischievously took one very important piece out. And you're trying to manipulate all the pieces, and you put it together. Well, that's not a circle, that's more of an oval. So you try again, and you're like, hey, this can't be done. And the frustration of that, you may say, man, that is cruel. Why would God do that? Well, hopefully that person that's trying to put that puzzle together would come to me and say, it can't be done, show me the answer. That's exactly what God wants man to do, because he tries to put life together. He still comes up with emptiness, grasping for the wind. It's all vanity. It's like a soap bubble. What's the point of life? That he'd finally look up and say, God, I need answers from you. And the reason that is because sin has been injected into the world. And because sin has been injected into the world, man is not complete and nothing will satisfy. So life is designed that I have to kind of grope with these things, battle with these things, try and figure out eternity, how it relates to the way in which God works. It's God-given task. It's my task that God's given to me as an individual. Hopefully I'll quit and say, uncle, and say, God, I need your help. And I was so stubborn that I had to be flat on my back with my life being threatened with a bad heart for me to finally look up to God and say, okay, I'm ready for some answers. That's how stubborn we are. Anything but God. So, the bottom line, it's because of sin. Pretty simple illustration. How many of you men, before we had our phone that had maps on it, like to get out of the car, pull over and ask for directions? Because there's one guy here, we're going to stone him after the church service. There was just something that you could not bring yourself to go and ask for directions from somebody. It's called pride. Right or wrong, that's what it was. I still don't like to take directions. When I, especially when my kids were young, I would get something, I'd build it, a toy at midnight, and they'd have the instructions. My first thing I'd do is I'd look at the instructions and go, who needs these? And then I'd start building. And then I'd have extra pieces left over. I'd say, these morons gave me extra pieces. What's wrong with them? And then when the thing wouldn't work, then I'd be scrambling the trash to get the directions. This is how it works with God, but with life. And God says, I've designed things this way. So it's not cruel. It's only to get us to seek after Him because of sin. Pride brings a self-reliance. I could figure it out. I'm the captain of my own ship. I'm in control. And God's sitting back. I'm going to let you just frustrate yourself to death or unto death. Then you'll finally look to me. So it's a very gracious thing that God has done through this God-given task, this burdensome task. But the worst thing to do is to lash out at God and blame Him. Sin, our sin, Adam's sin, is what messed things up, not God. And God says, I have a way to fix that. I'm going to allow life to be empty apart from me. that man would seek after me. It's their God-given task, and they're going to be held responsible someday for that. So I'm thankful that he makes us unrestful until we find our rest in our relationship with him. The third thing is a general conclusion, verse 14 and 15, and we've seen this last week. He says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. So remember those phrases, under the sun means primarily a life, just the way life is lived, apart really from the very presence and influence and God being at the center. He says, I used wisdom, I tried everything, and I came to the conclusion that all is vanity and emptiness, even frustration. And I love that phrase, grasping for the wind. You just could never satisfy. And so what he's saying is wisdom is good, philosophy is good, any pursuit is good, but in and of itself, it just does not solve the problem. It just does not satisfy. So wisdom alone can't satisfy this frustration, this God-given task that he's given to us. Goes on to say, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. What is crooked? I'm going to assume that what he's referring to is he sought out humanity and he saw that man's crooked. The man's messed up. There's something wrong with us. And although he had wisdom, he could identify the problem. He may be able to label it like a disease, but he can't fix it. Wisdom alone could not fix the problems of humanity. And what is lacking? There is that he didn't understand. There's always a lack of wisdom because we're not as smart as God. God withholds things from us or things that we just can't possibly understand or know. So even if you had all the knowledge, you still lack wisdom on certain areas. So think of a man that has the wisdom that God gave him, more wisdom than all of us. He sees the basic problems, but he still can't solve those basic problems. How frustrating is that? Man's basic problems of war, been around really since Cain and Abel. Got poverty. How do we solve that? Injustices, suffering. I mean, the problems are the same. And you can know all about those things, but wisdom is not going to be able to solve that. It cannot change the basic nature of mankind. If that was the case, then the smartest people in the world would be the most moral. They'd be the best people. That's people of quality. And that is just not the case. If so, college campuses would be the greatest place on the planet. And they are some of the places of the most unrest. People start learning and they start protesting. And some of those years are some of the most unhappiest for people because they're learning things and they're getting more and more frustrated. That's where movement starts. So knowledge itself is not going to solve the problem. And we have access to a lot of knowledge. Someone did a little survey, tried to illustrate this way. It said, if you could take all the knowledge from year zero to 1845 and put it in a graph, it would be 1 inch tall. In comparison, 100 years from 1845 to 1945, it would be 3 inches. So it tripled in 100 years. From 1945 to 1975, if you took all the knowledge available, it said it would be on the chart the height of the National Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., in comparison. And now knowledge is doubling every 2 years on the earth. And with the internet and just a phone in your hands going online, there's so much information and knowledge that you can have. I mean, so much at your disposal. I looked up a couple of facts. Do you realize that the weight of a gnat is 0.01 ounce? And if you had a million of those, they'd weigh a pound. Did you know that a male flea weighs more than a female flea? Total useless information unless you're on Double Jeopardy and you get these questions and you can rack up some money. So how does that help you? And you have access to all this information, but it's still not going to bring satisfaction, and it's not going to be able to fix the problems of mankind. Aren't you glad for the gospel that comes and straightens mankind out and brings salvation and gives us an ultimate eternal purpose in life? It's got to be at the very center. One other thing to support what Solomon is saying, I went online and looked up the highest rate of suicide by professions. And you're going to be surprised at some of these things. The number one was doctors. I mean, those are some of the most intelligent people, spend years studying. Number two, this one's strange, dentists. Now, I have no idea. Someone said because they're down in the mouth, but I'm not sure about that. But this one shocked me. This one literally shocked me. Number seven was electricians. Very shocking. Get it? Shocking? Electrician? You guys are an hour behind, too. Come on. Keep up with my jokes. Number six was real estate workers. Now, I tell you, the shock is my dad was an electrician. My wife's a real estate worker. And then farm workers were eight, pharmacists nine, scientists ten. Pretty radical. I think those should be some of the most contented type of people, but they're not. What brings that on? Well, it's not the knowledge that they had that rescued them, that's for sure. So that's the general conclusion. Let's look at the painful conclusion in verses 16 through 18. So he says, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who are before me in Jerusalem. Now he's going to look inward. The first portion he looked outward. I'm going to study all these things. Now he's looked at himself and says, I've gained all this wisdom. Now, you might read that, and some people really slam Solomon here and saying, oh, I've become great and I got all this wisdom. If it's true, he may not be boasting here. He'd just be stating a fact for the purpose of the book. It's not like I'm not just some sort of guy that has a hobby of this stuff. I have all this wisdom and knowledge. My heart understood great wisdom and knowledge. So verse 13, he says, he set his heart. Verse 16 says, I commune. Chapter 2, verse 11, I set in my heart. These are all these musings that are going on the inside. Now, in looking at this, though, I think man is very prideful. They think if they can't find an answer, there is no answer. Like they've investigated it all and they've come to the conclusion. It's like that is so limited. So very limited. Or even things that they discovered. I mean, we use the word, this guy discovered gravity. As if like it wasn't there before he discovered it. I mean, I couldn't help but think of Christopher Columbus discovering America. There were people living on there, so what did he really discover? He discovered that people were living there. But it's like this big thing of discovery, as if this guy is so smart. Well, all they're doing is finding out what God has already put in the created order. And it's taken us this long to figure these things out. So no one's really discovering anything. Like, they're creating it. God created it, and we're just catching up with what he's already done. It reminds me of the story when the Russian astronauts went up into space, and one of them boldly said, well, I looked around, I was out there, and I didn't see God at all. And one guy wisely said, well, if you had stepped out of the cabin, you would have saw him immediately. So you really can't, prideful man thinks, I'm going to investigate, and my conclusions are true. And they get around to other people who believe the same thing. It's really just kind of shared ignorance. They're affirming each other in their foolishness, because they think they're so wise. To me, that's what evolution is about, atheism about. They think they're so intelligent that they could conclude all the matter. Here's the finality, because I have determined and discovered these things. Solomon says, and I set my heart to know wisdom, know madness and folly. I perceive that this also was grasping for the wind. So knowledge in itself doesn't satisfy. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases in knowledge increases in sorrow. So the more you learn, the more painful life gets. Maybe that's why doctors are the ones that have the highest suicide rate. They work so hard, and they're close to their patients, and although they try and keep a distance, they're able to identify what the problem is. They can label it. They can label a name that we can't even pronounce what the disease is, but they can't do anything about it in many cases. That's grief. To know all about this disease, and it's still conquering them, no matter they're frustrated. No wonder they're frustrated. Ignorance truly is bliss. I find the more I learn, the more difficult life is, the more painful it can be. I remember my first year in college at Point Loma. I had a political science class. I wasn't really interested in politics at all, but it was part of general education. And if you wanted to get extra credit, you had to watch the debate that they're going to put there in the cafeteria. And it was Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. My first presidential debate. And up to that point, I really didn't know what a Democrat or a Republican was. It's hard to tell nowadays as well. for other reasons, but back then, I had no idea. I just liked the way Ronald Reagan spoke and his humor, and he was slick. And ever since that debate, then I started learning about politics. I haven't gotten any happier. I've definitely gotten more and more miserable. The more I study, the more frustrated I get. The more I know about politics, the more I know what happens in Washington, the more pain and sorrow comes along. Ignorance truly is bliss. So wisdom itself, Solomon says, brings pain and suffering. So if you're just going to pursue after knowing things, be ready for grief and for sorrow. So here's a guy that's investigated all the problems of life, all the issues of life, and it's painful because there isn't any answers in that wisdom. And that's a frustration that intelligent people experience today. They can look at the world, they can identify the problems, and they realize that they are helpless to fix it. It's like grasping for the winds. So one man put it this way, philosophy is a study that enables a person to be unhappy more intelligently. I like that. So, that's a painful conclusion. After you take just all the human wisdom available, you look at life, you analyze everything, and you come up with an emptiness, you come up with a painful situation. You know, I stand and do a lot of memorial services. And one of the things I try to do, I try to identify with the human people suffering, because I know they're hurting, and I try and cover that in a compassionate way, and I try and comfort them. But you know what? I'm glad I don't end there. And I tell people that. I'm glad I have more than a message that says, I'm going to pray for you, I care for you. I'm able to stand up there and say, there's one answer to death. And that's Jesus, who's the resurrection and the life. And that brings me great joy to present that message at a memorial service for those who would grasp on to it. And things can be straightened by God that are crooked. And that eventually God is going to set all things in order. So we're subjected, Romans 8:20 says, but we're subjected in hope. We have the hope, the assurance that the Lord's going to work all these things out. So wisdom. Get all the education you can, learn all that you can, but realize it's not an end in itself. The Bible doesn't say don't be smart, don't be intelligent, don't exercise your brain. That's not it. But it says if that's the goal, that's the focus, you're going to end up more frustrated than before you started. You're going to learn a lot, and you're going to see more problems, and you're going to be less equipped to deal with them. That's Solomon's conclusion about wisdom in itself. In chapter 2, we get three more pursuits, and they're pretty simple to follow. And they're maybe just words of exhortation to us of saying, let's put everything in perspective. So the second pursuit is joy itself. Verses 1 through 3. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also is vanity. With mirth, merriment, or joy, instead of wisdom, I'll go on the lighter side of life. Maybe he had court jesters that were there. Solomon could hire the best. Probably the Three Stooges in my category. I said of laughter, madness, and mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guarding my heart with wisdom, and lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under the heaven all the days of their lives. So now he talks about with wine. Now he's not talking about a drunkard, because he says, I pursued it, whatever this world has to offer in pleasure, but I still kept my wisdom. Now the opposite is true of what the Bible says about the drunkard. It says the drunkard puts himself or considers himself with the sober. You ever been around a drunk and they think like they're fooling you, and they think that you don't notice that they're kind of slobbering their speech and saying weird things? I ran into a guy Friday night at a baseball game that really doesn't like me. He hugged me 3 times and told me how good it was to see me. It's because he had a little bit too much alcohol in him. Shook my hand 5 times. It was just like I could see what's happening here. He didn't. Solomon's not talking about that. He's talking about, I'm going to have like the parties of parties and enjoy all that the world has to offer and see, maybe that'll bring some sort of satisfaction. Now, I want to read 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 22 to you, because this is what Solomon had daily at his household. Now, Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. So 100 bushels of flour, 300 bushels of meal. One man said that if you put all that together, that if you were to make the bread out of that meal, that's 2 pounds of bread for 14,000 people. And 1.5 pounds of meat for 14,000 people. That's what he had available on a daily basis. All the food that he could eat. So he had thousands of people around him there, and he celebrated all the time, daily, in these big feasts. That's pretty radical stuff. And you say, well, I'd like to try that. Well, I have had the privilege of going on a pretty nice cruise ship. And the first night, I gorged myself. Man, you get pizza at 2 o'clock in the morning. This is like close to heaven. Then you go get an ice cream sundae and all the ice cream that you want. Well, by about the fifth day, it's like, you want to go eat a pizza? I'm not sure. Want to go eat another ice cream? I've had 30 of them. We're good. So eventually, it just doesn't satisfy. Solomon says, I pursued all those, and I didn't have any limits. See, we think, yeah, I know, but I have the limits. That's the problem. And Solomon's saying, no, time out. This is why I'm writing this book, to tell you I had it all and more than anyone could ever have and enjoy, and it just doesn't satisfy. So don't put off happiness and contentment and satisfaction until you get the next raise, the nicer this, the nicer that. You're fooling yourself. I love that passage. Godliness with contentment is great gain. The third area of pursuit is, for lack of a better term, hobbies. Now, Solomon is going to talk about building these amazing things, but what are these projects? If you have all the money in the world, they really are just large hobbies that he could afford. So I made my works great, verse 4. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. Now, Solomon is going to focus on what he did, I think, for himself, for his own purposes. Because from verse 4 to 11, 32 times a personal pronoun is going to be used. I, me, my. So here's a guy who says, I know, I'll just build a bunch of stuff. And Solomon had a labor force of thousands of people to build from. You could read that out in 1 Kings chapter 5. What are some of the things that he built? What's he most famous for? He built the temple. That took him 20 years to build that thing. 20 years of a pursuit. After he built the temple, he says, well, I'm going to build myself a house. And he spent 13 years building himself a house. So imagine how awesome that house must have been. If it took 20 years to build a temple, 13 years for his house. He built another house in the forest of Lebanon. I guess that was a summer place. He built another palace for the daughter of Pharaoh. And then he built cities. This guy built cities. So it's in Gezer, Hazor, Megiddo, Beth-horam, Tadmor, which was in the desert. So not only did he build the temple, he built his own house, built houses for other people, palaces, and then he built cities. See, we think, well, I like my house, but I just need to fix it a little bit. Then I could really enjoy it. Just need to redo my kitchen, my bathroom, put a new roof on the bedrooms. Then I'll be happy. Just enjoy what God's given to you. You're not going to be more satisfied or happier. Nor do you want to feel guilty for what God's given to you. Enjoy what he's given to you. Got a house? Enjoy it. Got finances? Enjoy them. Just don't make that the pursuit. No, I think there's nothing wrong with building things. God's a creator. He's a builder. We've received that from him. But apart from God, building a life really isn't what is going to satisfy. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water growing trees of the grove. This guy, there's some pools that are found down in Hebron for agricultural purposes. And the average size of these pools were 420 feet long, 230 feet wide, 40 to 50 feet deep. So when this guy said he planted some vineyards, we're not talking about 10 trees in the backyard of different types of fruit. We're talking huge supplies of stuff. These were his grand hobbies that he comes and says, this didn't satisfy either. So it's not, if I only had this, if I could only do that, if I only try this, happiness is just right around the corner. The last pursuit is possessions, verses 7 through 11. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. So he goes from projects to hobbies to joy. And now maybe what he's saying is I also had people around me. That's what I'm missing, is I just need more people around me. I just need more deeper relationships. And people pursue after all these, trying to find some sort of lasting thing. And what happens with those relationships? They don't all work out, do they? Sometimes the marriages don't work out. And if that's the entirety of your life, well, your life is more than your marriage. Your life is more than your friends. And for Solomon, with all the money that he had, how would he know if they, well, they were servants, but anyone around him, how would he know if they liked him or his money? And relationships don't always last. Things don't always last. Pursuits don't always last. I was thinking about it. I was listening to the news a couple months back, and I'm not into the MMA fighting, but I know I'm aware of it. But the gal, Ronda Rousey, that lost, she went into such a depression, she wanted to commit suicide. I was just shocked by it. I don't know why I was shocked, but I was. She lost one match. Her whole identity was wrapped up in whatever, and that thing came crumbling down. So, oh, life's worthless. Life's over. See how empty life is in itself, even these type of pursuits. Might be people. Might be things. Let's read on what else he had. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered myself silver and gold. Well, someone estimated what that might have been, just the gold. Because it says he made silver like rocks. Like they were, silver was nothing. Yearly, he had an increase of 25 tons of gold. 25 tons. Could be up to $2 billion. But $2 billion back then, that could almost buy, you know, continents. I was listening to the news at Zuckerberg. His increase was $11 billion. This last year. $11 billion. I wonder if he's happy. I'm happy, and I surely didn't come anywhere of that sort of increase. This guy had it all. Gold and special treasures of kings, so things only kings could get. Maybe jewels and that type of stuff. And of the provinces, I acquired male and female singers. So not, he didn't have music, he bought the whole band. And they performed before him. You imagine, oh, I'm going to have the Beatles. I'm going to buy the Beatles, and they're going to play before. That's the type of money this guy had. The delights of the sons of men and musical instruments of all kinds. Now, musical instruments are interesting. It's either musical instruments or it's translated harem in another place. So maybe talking about the women. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So he did this, and he still had his wisdom. And here's his conclusion, verse 10, 11. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. So whatever I wanted, I got. That's why we're to listen to this guy. That it's not, I just get this, move here, arrive at this place in life, attain to this, then I'll be satisfied. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 8 says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. That means whatever you could see and you want and you get it, you're not going to be satisfied. Because your eyes are attached metaphorically to your soul. And so whatever physically is out there is not going to satisfy the longing of the soul. That's why we have to be refocused on eternal things. And even as Christians, we can kind of get our focus off that. And we can start pursuing after too strongly after the temporal. And that's why church on a regular basis is mandatory for us. Not as a law, but if you just kind of check in with God every once in a while, the temporary becomes the focus. And the eternal things become really small, and more empty you're going to feel. David had that problem. He says, I was envious of the boastful. He says, then I went into the house of God, and then I kind of remembered this is how they're going to end up. So I wasn't jealous of them any longer. So the study of the Bible gets us back on eternal things. There's something about our satisfaction in life is related to the degree that we focus on eternal things. And if we'd focus on eternal things, then we could enjoy the temporary. But if we're trying to have satisfaction with the temporary, apart from the eternal, we'll never have any satisfaction. We'll need more and more and more and more and more and more and go from thing to thing to thing, person to person, experience to experience to experience. But we get the eternal dimension down, then we could, without guilt, and fully enjoy, because we have the right perspective on the temporary things. I want you, God wants you to enjoy the temporary things. But you can't enjoy them in and of themselves. We get the eternal focus, right? Then these other things become even a greater blessing. Because we realize I didn't acquire them. God gave them to me, and He gave them for my enjoyments. And be thankful to Him for those things. This is what Solomon's trying to bring us to in this entire book. He's not just saying, oh, life's worthless, don't do it. He says, here's how you pursue these things. And you will enjoy life much greater if you get the eternal dimension set and focused, hardened in stone. And this is what church brings us back to over and over and over again. Because the eye will never be satisfied. Spiritually as well, pastors will say, well, I just need a bigger church, then I'll be a happy pastor. And spiritual things could be misunderstood as well. You have to realize whatever you have, God has given it to you. And Solomon says, I didn't hold back anything. Anything I wanted, I got. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the reward from all my labor. So he worked hard, he got all these things, he enjoyed it, but then, because that's where he's trying to find satisfaction, verse 11 comes, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity. It's like a soap bubble. All these things I pursued, it was good for a while, and then it popped, and there it's gone. I was left with that same feeling of frustration. And grasping for the winds, there was no profit under the sun. That word profit, again, we looked at last week, means something that's left over. So I do all this, and what am I really, what really remains? The joy is an experience, right? It's a feeling, it comes and it goes, even works. The project's over. I got to build another house and build another palace and moving on. And it just, there's nothing that remains as we pursue the temporary things just for themselves. But as we focus on the eternal things first and foremost, we don't end up at verse 11. See, I understand this more than many of you because I get a lot of people that will come to me. They've tried everything. And now that's their last result, I have to go speak to a pastor about these things. It's like, I might as well try the God thing, the eternal thing. And like they've exhausted themselves. They haven't found anything out there. And they're so desperate, they'll even speak to me. And they'll be open to God's word. So, Solomon here would say, set your heart on the eternal things. That's the only thing that brings lasting satisfaction. When satisfaction is there, all the temporary things will have their rightful place. You won't allow them to move your heart. You won't allow them to be the thing you have to have and end up kind of frustrated and empty. And I'll say this as the last part, especially, it relates more to women today as well, but careers are fine. What I tell people is be the best at what you can. If you're a firefighter or teacher or whatever it is, learn all you can and be an expert in that field. But at the same time, that can't be the focus. You can't just be the best at that in and of itself. Because probably in the process, you might mess up your marriage, might mess up your kids, you get out of balance, you're spending way too much time in that pursuit. Now you got angry kids behind you because you're not around or left, and your marriage isn't what it should be because this became the priority. It's so easy to get there, even as Christians. It's so easy that even pastors do this. They pursue after their church and after ministry, and they leave their wife and kids behind, and they come back, and they're bitter and angry and hurt. And that story's been repeated way too many times in the ministry and in humanity. But when we have our satisfaction in God, all these other things just balance things out. This is my second closing I'll finish with, because a lot of people ask me. They'll say, how do you balance things? Ministry and family. I tell them I don't. I don't balance. I don't say, I'm going to have so many hours here, so many hours here. What I do is I set my heart on God, and God directs my path. And He tells me, you're spending too much time over here on these things. You're neglecting. Get over there and take care of it. So I allow Him to control my time. And there's times where I'm so busy, absorbed in what God has me to do in ministry, but every time when there's that busy season, there's this lull that comes. Now, if I fill that time with more ministry and more opportunities, then I'm neglecting my family. God balances my time because I want Him. I want His will, His purpose. There's nothing I'm pursuing after. I don't have to have anything. God set me free of that when I became a Christian because that's where I was before. This is my third closing. I've learned if I have to have something, I got to give that to God. I got to put that on the altar. But it's so important. I just... gotta, if this is the thing that I have to have, God, just let me get to have this. And then, you know, it doesn't matter anything after that. Put that on the altar and let God decide if he wants to give it to you. Because then that becomes your God. That becomes your pursuit. And that's when things get out of balance. Amen? Let's pray together.